Welcome back to the Language Creation Society podcast. I'm your host, Cy Emrys. Today we have linguist Erica Oakwood, author of the just-released book, In the Land of Invented Languages, Esperanto Rockstars, Klingon Poets, Loglan Lovers, and the Mad Dreamers Who Tried to Build a Perfect Language. Erica attended the second Language Creation Conference, as well as a Klingon Kibbok, Lajban Logfest, and Esperanto Conference, not to mention the numerous interviews and other research evident in her book. We discuss the history of language invention, what it means for language to be successful, and some stories that didn't make it into the book. So could you tell me what you were working on these last couple of years?
I've been writing this book, In the Land of Invented Languages, which is sort of a history of the urge to create languages, mostly the urge to control language and improve upon it. But ending up in the story of people who work with it, not to improve on it, but to sort of pay homage to language, the current crop of language inventors.
Would you say that historically people have been more interested in sort of an engineered approach to conlanging than in artistic?
Yes, I think in general the approach to conlanging or to the language invention has been spotting a problem with language. It's not either not clear enough, it's ambiguous, it's not international enough, and trying to find a way to solve that problem through human ingenuity. And usually this doesn't work out very well. But within that whole history, I think there's always been an artistic drive behind the process of language invention. Language inventors have particular things they like. They like certain sounds, or they like certain grammatical devices and make use of the ones that they do like. So in a way, even when an inventor is trying to remedy some problem they see with language, they're using tools which appeal to them for whatever reason, and what they come up with is an expression of their personality.
So a lot of the book that you spend the first few chapters, at least, on Esperanto and a little bit on Klingon up front, but then later more, you spend it on John Wilkins, quite a bit. That I found particularly interesting, in fact. And Esperanto and bliss symbols. And only later do you get into the modern sort of conlanging. Is there any particular reason for that? I don't know how you went about structuring the book, so I'm curious.
More it's about following the historical flow that people have always been making up languages for literary purposes, but generally those languages weren't very wholly worked out. They sort of served the story a little bit, like the language of the Lilliputians in Gulliver's Travels, but the author didn't make a whole, lay out the whole morphology and syntax and how the language would work in great detail. In many of those cases, it's kind of the language is there, it's kind of an afterthought. But what I did, I guess, with the book is follow some eras in language invention where what people were working on matched the obsessions of the time with respect to language. So in the 17th century, there was this obsession with creating a mathematics of language where you could break down concepts into their smaller component parts and then build the concepts out of those component parts in a predictable, consistent way. That was the obsession of the times, and that's the kind of languages people were coming up with. In the 19th century, it was the obsessions of the time with a sort of fight against nationalism and concern with international communication. It was much easier to communicate between countries with the steam engine and the expanse of industrialization. People were coming into contact with each other, and they started to worry a lot about, you know, having a communication system that everyone could use easily. And so the Esperanto-type languages were popular then. And so in general, the languages I chose to focus on were sort of the peak quintessential language of each era. of language invention, which matches what the obsession of the time was, I guess. And conlanging comes at the end, where now we're in more of an entertainment era, I guess, where you do art for its own sake, and you don't need to have a practical goal to invent something and enjoy it. You do it because you enjoy it, and you're lucky enough to be able to find everyone else who enjoys that thing too, because of the way we communicate socially now. If you have the tiniest little obsession, you can find someone else that has that obsession, and they can appreciate what you do, and you can appreciate what they do. So.
All the joys of the internet.
Yes.
How do you get the idea to do the book?
Well, I got the idea because I wanted to find a book like this. I was sort of casually look through invented languages books and libraries and wonder, you know, why did these people think they could build a better language? And then I would read about, you know, Esperanto. Well, people really speak it, and they have translated all of Shakespeare's works into it. And I thought, you know, really? Really? Like, I wanted somebody to tell me, like, okay, when they get together at these Esperanto conferences, here's what they do. I couldn't find anything like that, and so I just decided to jump into it myself. And so it's partially these biographical sketches of language inventors, me trying to understand the motivations of someone who could sit down and say, you know what, I look around at these languages, they don't do it right, I think I could do a better job, and look at their justifications and their life stories. And also, for the languages that have gained a following, I would go and see what really do they do when they get together and quote-unquote speak Klingon or Esperanto.
Right.
And I found out that they do, you know, they do a lot more than I expected them to. I was surprised in many respects by what I found.
How did you first even learn of conlangs? Most people, in my experience at least, who learn of conlangs or talk to conlangers are conlangers themselves, and they're brought to it because they have that bug. But you seem to be more just interested in it from the outside. At least from your book, you've said that you've had, you know, sparks of being inspired to maybe make a language, but you didn't really have the desire to follow through with that.
Yeah, I don't have the discipline, I guess, it takes to be a conlanger. I can sit around and come up with, you know, ideas I think are neat, but I don't have the intense concentration it takes to sit down and actually work it all out. But I guess I come to it from a place that many conlangers do as well, is in that I just love languages, and I'm interested in all things about language and the interesting ways in which they work. And I suppose the difference is that most people who are interested in language and love language feel sort of offended by conlanging. It's like, you know, unnatural. It's, why would you want to mess with something when we already have all these
wonderful
natural languages? You know, why do you want to go that way?
Yeah.
But I, for whatever reason, thought to take those language inventors at their word and sit down and, okay, you say this is a great language and it's really easy to learn and it will make me think better. All right, I'll sit down and I'll try to learn it. I'll try to, or at least translate something into it, which was what I did with a couple of the languages. And I can't say that they convinced me, but I can say that the sensation I get looking through these languages and how they work is not all that different from the one I get looking through some, you know, fantastic, bizarre Caucasian language with interesting grammatical features. They're both sort of interesting puzzles in a way that appeal to language-minded people who love languages. So I can appreciate the work and dedication that goes into these projects, even if I'm not capable of doing it myself.
Do you think it takes a certain kind of person to make a language? Or what are they like?
What does it take to be a real conlanger? Huh? Well, I mean, really what it takes, the thing that I don't have, is follow-through. It's pretty easy to come up with ideas, and, you know, many sort of newbie conlangers are full of these great ideas, and then the more experienced conlangers have to sit them down and say, you know, you are probably the 4 millionth person to come up with that idea. And not only that, there's 500 natural languages that already do that. And, you know, and then you either get discouraged at that point or you keep going and coming up with new ideas. But I think probably the real, you know, upper echelon conlangers aren't so much about coming up with clever ideas as they are about satisfying this personal vision that they have for whatever reason. They just, like Tolkien, loved the sound of Welsh words. And he loved it so much that he had to create a language that captured that feeling even more. It wasn't something he sat down and thought, you know, I bet people would think I was really cool and clever if I did this, or yeah, this is an interesting way I could, you know, solve a problem. It was, you know, he almost sort of wished he wasn't so obsessed by it. He did it to fulfill this sort of inner instability caused by a desire for some aesthetic thing in the world, and he needed to put it in the world. And I think, you know, a lot of the really great conlangs come from that urge to express this aesthetic that is, you know, is very personal. So that would be the thing that everyone has in common. They have this drive and this personal aesthetic that they need to satisfy, but it's a different kind of aesthetic for everyone. So, you know, if you're not so interested in romance languages, you know, that romance conlang doesn't speak to you, but you can understand where it comes from in terms of the desire. You know?
And that sort of reminds me of what you just said about that you're not sure that some of these languages have quite convinced you. And it seems to me that something like Quenya doesn't even try to convince you of anything. It's just there to please Tolkien.
Yes, it does. It is wildly successful in meeting its goals because it satisfies the inventor, and that's the only goal. The ones I talk about that, you know, that I'm not convinced by are where the goal is, I will make a language that you cannot say anything unambiguous in.
Yeah.
That kind of project.
Yeah.
You know? So I sit down and I look at it and say, all right, well, let's see how it works. And of course, that doesn't work. You can't make a language that's unambiguous. So if that's your goal, you fail. Or if your goal is, you know, to create a universal language that everyone in the world will use, you know, that goal doesn't work out either. And that's, you know, most of the history that I look at is that kind of goal, this engineering problem, a linguistic problem to be solved. But it ends up with the conlangers where it's not a linguistic problem they want to solve. It's an artistic problem. And those can be solved because if you're satisfied with what you produce, you've solved the problem. And, you know, who am I to sit down and say it works or it doesn't work? It doesn't matter what I think. You know?
Do you think that international auxiliary languages have, in some sense, failed incidentally? Or is this something inherent? Or do you think they have failed? Maybe from your perspective, they're successful.
Well, I think I have to say Esperanto is not a failure. I started off thinking, you know, where they sort of get together and go, blah, 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 where is the library? You know, or you know, kind of this level one, chapter one language textbook kind of speak. But no, I mean, they're really speaking it. There are native Esperanto speakers. It's a living language. I'm fully convinced of that. But it's not a universal language. And it is, you know, that one of its goals is to sort of foster peace between nations. People sort of harp on it a lot for being naive in that respect, because, of course, people can speak the same language and still not get along. But there is a sort of spirit of brotherhood, I suppose you'd call it, among this ersatz Esperanto world or diaspora that they've created. And it's people who care about that kind of thing are drawn to it, and therefore the community that they've built around it has those tendencies. And so while it doesn't succeed in the sense of it became the world language and brought peace to everyone. No, of course not. But it succeeded in a different way in becoming a particular language of a particular community that does care about those kind of things and does seem, you know, genuinely nice to each other and interested in international exchange and all those nice things.
So it succeeded like any other language may, you might call it succeeding.
Yes,
It's a language of a culture that's shared by a certain group of people.
Yes, and it's alive and it's passed down and it has, there are ways of being Esperanto-y and sort of created a culture. Esperanto is a success, but I would say that it succeeded in ways that don't exactly match up with the original goals or the original criteria for success, but it found another way to be a success by just being a living language in the world, which is pretty amazing. It went from not existing to being a real language in the world. So.
Do you think it's possible for a language to become universal other than through the nice traditional gun, germs, and steel method?
Well, I don't really know. If you would have asked me before I started, I would have said, of course not. You just can't tell people, here's a language, speak it. We have so many examples of, so many languages. People, like Irish, people love Irish. They're attached to it. They're emotionally involved in it. But even though the government forces them to take Irish in school, they don't speak it. What makes people speak a language? You can't impose it from above. But there are some weird little success stories like Esperanto or modern Hebrew, for example, where kind of conscious control gets people speaking a language that they don't otherwise speak. So I would be I'm hesitant to say that, no, this can never work. But, most of the evidence out there would indicate that you can't impose a language from above. If you wanted to do it, you'd have to sort of trick people into doing it, I guess, from below.
What about small sort of changes to language? Like Korean's writing system was created one day, if I remember right. And that one has succeeded pretty well. But on the other hand, you have something like the French, I forget what it's called.
Academie
Française, right. And that is pretty much a failure. So do you think that people might have more success if they were just trying to alter languages in small amounts?
Perhaps, although I don't know. I mean, we have plenty of people out there saying, trying to protect English from decay. Don't use the singular they as a pronoun. That's not correct, but people do it anyway.
I do.
And, the louder you try to complain about it, the more letters to the editor you write, the more of a little fuss budget you look like, and then people, the whole thing becomes uncool to complain about it in the first place. So you could do yourself harm by trying to put the reins on language change or try to force people to speak a certain way or preserve a certain use.
What if you're not trying to preserve it, but you're trying to direct change?
I don't know. I think your job is a really difficult one, but I wouldn't say that it's impossible. I've learned not to say that it's impossible, because looking at the Esperanto example or the modern Hebrew example from, if I was around in 1880, I would have said the same thing about those projects. So you just never know what's going to appeal to people. But yeah, in general, man does not control language in the way that he can, reverse the flow of a river or do other magical engineering types of things. Language will not be engineered in that way.
Right. You've mentioned the ways that the languages that you've described in the book parallel the culture of the time and how people interacted at the time. How do you think that they would have progressed if they had access to the internet?
I don't know. I suspect the Volapük Esperanto wars would have gone on a lot longer. Yeah, it is. It's easier to find people It's easier to find followers with the internet. So, some of these smaller projects might have had more of a chance, more followers to get the ball rolling. But on the other hand, something like the internet allows a lot more fractiousness and more projects. You find, even today, you can find little arguments between the Novial people and the Edo people.
Those are fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it sort of makes it harder for any particular project to die out, and you get a lot of people fighting with each other over who's better and which is the best and which has the best features. You have, instead of one lonely engineer with a vision, you've got thousands of engineers trying to contribute. But I think that's any successful invented language ultimately hands the project over to the people who are into it, and they're going to make changes and destroy its perfection.
Although it seems to me that only auxiliary languages really care about who's the best, because for them it matters which one is the best and which one sort of has market share dominance. And for all the other kinds of conlangs, that's sort of a secondary desideratum.
Yeah. Well, I guess if you want to attract a following, then you've got to have a marketing pitch. And part of it will be, this one is the one, this one will make you think better, and this one is, you know, has all the features you're looking for in a conlang, as if people are out there kind of shopping for the best one.
It seems to me that from what you've written, at least, I think you actually do believe that Lojban and Wilkins' philosophical language have made you think better, or at least have broken your mind in an interesting way. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that they've fulfilled the mission of, in the case of Wilkins, we can speak in the truth. I don't think it fulfills that mission, but I think what Wilkins did by breaking down the universe into its essential component meanings is he really defined English very well, and the shades of meaning in English, and how, where in the universe of concepts the words we use place us when we use them in English. But I don't think that he exposed, you know, the truths of the universe necessarily, but I think he did a wonderful job exploring meaning and how it works. What is meaning, and how do words relate to each other in English? And with Lojban, yeah, I mean, wrapping your mind around a Loglan or Lojban sentence really forces you to, again, think about meaning in a whole new way and how we communicate meaning. But I don't necessarily think that, well, I would say that the goal, at least, of a logical language forcing you to think more logically isn't met just because it's so difficult to speak a logical language. And very few people can even do the very basic things in a language like that.
Right. Do you think people ever learn a language for its features, like whether it's universal or whether it's logical or whatever, or for the associated culture of the language?
Yeah, I don't know that you can convince a person to learn a language because of some feature. You know, you should really learn this language because it has very beautiful vowels, or you should learn this language because it has a perfect paradigm of verb conjugation or something. Just because learning a language involves quite a bit of work, and I don't know that the features of a language are good enough enticement for the average person to do the work that it takes.
What is?
Wouldn't these 900 years of language adventures like to know? I think it's pretty hard to predict. What you have to do is create a community that people want to join for whatever reason, and you don't know what the successful piece is going to be. I would say something like Esperanto had its time and place, and if it had been a different year or a different place, any of its circumstances had changed by the littlest bit, it probably wouldn't have happened the way it did. Something like Klingon, you know, the people who were attracted to it, there was already a sort of culture in place that they wanted to be a part of, and here was something that made the experience of that even better. So the success of Klingon in that sense benefited greatly from having a community already in place, even though the Klingon-speaking community is a bit different from your run-of-the-mill Klingon community. The big guys who just dress up in costumes, they don't do that.
You've seen the Who's Geekier Than chart, right? Of the internet?
Yes, yeah. Yes, yeah, so the book starts with Klingon speakers occupy the lowest possible rung on the geek ladder. And then I list a few contenders, and including ham radio operators, and I did get some angry emails from ham radio operators, offended to be included in there with the Klingon speakers. So yeah, if you're a Klingon speaker, even the ham radio operators don't want to have anything to do with you.
So one of the things that you discuss in the book is how Loglen, or Lojban, was intentionally made to sort of test a Worf hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
And you're pretty skeptical about that, just because Lojban happens to be such a complex language that, you know, it couldn't even be learned to do the experiment in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Laudon, I think, is a somewhat less extreme example of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That you treat a little bit different, but you still feel that it's sort of never really got picked up. Do you think that any language that does try to intentionally do a Worf manipulation would work?
Well, my understanding of psycholinguistics or cognitive psychology is that if you want to do an experiment like that, you have to use native speakers. Otherwise, you have no way of evaluating or comparing people of comparable proficiency. And if you are learning an invented language, you won't be a native speaker of it. So I think the problem starts from the very beginning of the idea. Let's make up a language and teach it to people and then test whether it affects their mind somehow. I don't know that you'd be answering the Worf question if you did that, although there's a lot of disagreement on what that question is. So
suppose you had the ability to teach it to children as their native language. Would that be enough?
That would be, but that's sort of the desert island experiment, you know. Oh, we're going to take your kids and borrow them for a while, turn them into native speakers of Lojban, and then we'll give them back to you later. That's sort of what you'd have to do, and I don't know. not in this country. but yeah,
that's a practical matter. Like, what would the actual outcome of that be?
Yeah, I don't know. It's sort of, you can sort of do a little thought experiment about an otherworld Worf test using an artificial language. But in general, if it's an artificial language, if you try to teach it to, even if you were given some infants and tried to teach it to them natively, you would soon find out that your language will lose some of its features that you might be trying to use as tests, that you don't know what's going to happen to it as it gets pigeonized or creolized and turned into a living language, and very likely it's not going to retain a lot of those features that you're trying to experiment with.
That seems to have been the case for a lot of the languages that you discussed, where with use and starting to buck their creator, they kind of lost whatever the creator was trying to go for.
Yes. And that's, you know, if you have enough people to ruin your language, then you are a fabulous success.
Ironic.
If your language is hermetically sealed and keeping all its little features, then that means nobody is using it, so you're not so well off. I would say if someone's ruining your language, then you're doing great, because that means people are using it and they're interested in it. But yeah, they are going to ruin it.
It is an ironic sort of success.
Yes.
What about just for, as a second language, and not really intended to be a language on its own, but a language that specifically is intended to make you think differently by virtue of having learned the language?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good in something like that. I think Esperanto often is promoted as this kind of a way to get people into languages, because you can learn it a little more easily. You don't have to memorize all these irregularities, and it sort of teaches you about putting roots and endings together. And I haven't really looked at those kinds of studies, but from what I understand, it does make learning a language after that a bit easier. So if you learn Esperanto first, it makes learning French a little easier, or another language.
Although that's true of any second language also.
Yeah, that's true. Like if they were learning French, and then that would make Spanish a little easier. Yeah. So it's not necessarily that it's Esperanto. But yeah, with something like Loglan or Lojban or one of these Wilkins-type languages, it's so hard to get any kind of agreement on what's correct, because the standard of correctness is this 600-page tome. So if you said something in Lojban, you don't find out whether you're right or wrong because someone says, no, that's not how you say it. You say it this way. Although a lot of that goes on, but it's often unresolved. And what you have to do is go, you know, either go to the book and find out what you, if you've said what you really meant to say, or use a parsing program to find out if the computer will parse it the way you think it should be. And often you'll discover that you've made some error and haven't said exactly what you wanted to say. So when you speak it, no one ever quite knows if they're speaking it correctly, at least with respect to this external rule book. Now, they can speak to each other. You know, I wouldn't say it's up to the level of Klingon, but I did go to a Lojban conference, and there was a little bit of Lojban conversation, not much, but, you know, enough to be pretty impressive considering what the language is. But there was no... there's no way to know that anyone was saying exactly what they meant to say unless you take, I suppose, like the world's best Lojban speaker might be the one authority on whether things are coming out right. But even the best Lojban speakers back up and correct themselves in written form as well, so much less on the fly speaking. So.
Right. And you mentioned the Lojban conference, and I noted that in the course of researching your book, you actually went to several calling-related conferences, and you visited several people to have a chat with them. Could you just describe what that was like? What were the interesting parts of the different conferences?
Oh, yeah, it was great. I mean, if you like to travel and see the world, become an Esperantist. You know, they make it really easy for you. I went to one conference here and one in Havana, and it was a great experience, the one in Havana especially, because you're not there as a tourist so much. You're there with real Cuban people who are showing you around, taking you places you might not see as a tourist. And you can do that all over the world with Esperanto. So that experience was, that part of it was exhilarating. There's parts of it that are sort of really boring, and you sit through lots of grand speeches and this sort of Victorian rigmarole of pageantry, but the people are friendly and they'll show you around. You can stay with them for free, and so that was a nice thing. The Klingon, I went to a couple of the Klingon Kepas, which are their annual language meeting, and that was fun. There was a lot of games and activities, and the people who come together for these things know each other well. They've been doing it for a while. And then the Lojban meeting, which was sort of a brief. They don't have as much of a tradition of meetings, but there's usually one a year as an offshoot of some con or other. And this one was at the Philadelphia Science Fiction Convention. And everybody who comes together at these things have similar interests. So they have fun talking about the things they talk about, playing the games they like to play. There is a Lojban type. There's a Klingon type. There's an Esperanto type. They find each other, and that's why the languages kind of work, because there's this already built-in community of interest and way of being that then gets a language to put on it that they can continue doing their community thing with. So, yeah, it's for real. I would say, you know, Esperanto's big time for real living language, all the things you do in any natural language, no different from the way you do it in Esperanto. Klingon, little less. That, well, a lot less. There just aren't that many people who speak it that fluently, although the ones who do sound pretty fluent and natural when they do it. And then Lojban, I would say very, very, very few people who can have very, very basic conversations. But that doesn't make it any less of a community in the way that people who share the same interests and try to talk about it in a language that displays what their interests are.
So I have to ask, what do you think of our humble little conference?
Oh, I thought it was great. And as I say in the book, it kind of reinvigorated my own feeling for language that, you know, I always have loved languages, looking at the way they work and puzzling them out. And I did a PhD in linguistics and got sort of bogged down by the focus that's demanded when you do that sort of thing. You have to find data to make an argument, and the languages stop being so lively and interesting when you're doing that and become more sort of, well, containers of data. And being at the Conlang conference got that feeling back for me, because the sort of having fun and respecting the way that languages work. Because I'll say, you know, many people are sort of, linguists might be sort of offended by people creating their own languages when there's so many natural ones out there. But the ones that the conlangers that I saw at the conference, they were half the conversation, well, no, 80% of the conversation was about natural language, because all of the languages that people were coming up with were inspired by features of natural languages that they just liked for whatever reason and drove them to fulfill an artistic vision. And so I found being at the Conlang conference a sort of a celebration of natural language and an extension of natural language. And let's pay tribute to natural language by expanding on her features and taking them to extremes and mixing them up with other features that we like too. And I was very impressed by the level of discussion too. People really know a lot about, if you want to be a top level conlanger, you have to know a lot about natural languages and how they work. and you know, I could respect that. So that was fun for me.
I think that's sort of an incidental thing of our community, where we have a lot of people who are in fact linguists in their day life, and it wears off on all the other people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us are multilingual or however, and obviously we get some inspiration from that.
Yeah, and I think it's a great outlet for people who, you know, not everyone can go do a PhD in linguistics. You know, it's not a very practical career path, and some people just don't have the resources, and this is a great way to kind of live out the passion that might otherwise drive you into an academic career. Like Jeff Burke, for example, with his Central Mountain Languages, is going deep into the history of these Native American languages and finding an outlet for showing what he appreciates about them, and he doesn't have to go to grad school to do that. It's available to anyone who wants to follow that passion, and can't say it's any less appreciated than that thesis or that final thing produced at the end. So yeah, I hope I'm not getting myself into trouble here, but
I don't think so at all. I think he'd be flattered.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to denigrate what linguists produce when they do a PhD, but you know, but yeah, there are other ways to show your love for language and follow your passion for it and create something with it that's worthwhile. And it might be hard to convince a majority of people that it's worthwhile, but you can say that about lots of things.
Speaking of which, what was the reaction of your colleagues and your publishers to this book or to the project of doing this?
Well, I haven't really had a lot of reaction yet. Various people have seen various sections as I've gone along, but I got a great blurb from Will Shortz, the crossword puzzle editor of the New York Times.
Quote, a lively, informative, insightful examination of artificial languages. Who invents them? Why? And why most of them fail? I love this book. That's very nice of him.
Yeah, exactly. So it's people who like words and are interested in language, and I'll be interested to see what kind of reaction it gets, because lots of people who like words and languages that like the kind of books where you complain about all the ways that English is being destroyed, or you know, way people don't follow the rules. And this is sort of the opposite coin of that. It's sort of like, isn't it great that language isn't so neat and orderly as we might want it to be? And oh, here's what happens when you try to make it all neat and orderly. And boy, do we not want that.
Yeah, you led off one chapter with that, where you were saying, oh, you know, that instinct that says, oh, what if language were just more logical? Oh, you really don't want to open that can of worms.
Yeah. Yeah. We do not want to speak a logical language. Trust me. It's very, very difficult. We will not be able to talk to each other.
Ambiguity is useful. That actually reminds me, who is this book aimed at? Is it aimed at like the same people who enjoy Will Shortz's crosswords and puzzles?
In the general, the people who are interested in language in general. I mean, this is not a here, let me, you know, sit down and teach you the latest research on things kind of nonfiction book. It really just is an extension of my own curiosity. You know, I knew something about language, and I was curious about these people who invent languages and curious about what are people doing when they say they're speaking Klingon or Esperanto or whatever. And anyone who that question appeals to, I guess. But it is meant to take preconceived notions and turn them around. So people do not realize how many of these invented languages there have been over time. People are shocked. And I say, oh, I'm writing a book about invented languages. You mean like Esperanto and text speech? Or, you know, that's all about all people think of when they think of invented languages. So to say, here's a list of 500 languages I include in the appendix in the back. Here's 500 languages. And that's like not even half of them.
That's not even close to half of all the ones that have been produced in the last decade.
No, yeah. If you include the conlangs of the internet era, it's nothing. So yeah, to be able to look at that list and say, this has been going on forever. Like, I would like to read a history of the search for the perpetual motion machine and or a history of alchemy or something, you know, these instances where man takes on some problem and thinks that it can be solved.
Right.
And it appears that it can't be solved unless you define your problem, as the conlangers do, in a way that it can be solved.
Handy for us.
Yeah. So I guess that doesn't really answer the question of who's going to be interested in it, but I guess we'll see. We'll see. But yeah, that's central to the book, I think, is this quest to improve upon language and then why that doesn't work and why we should love language for what it is. And then we sort of end up with the conlangers who do what they do as an expression of that love rather than as a cure for the problems and the engineering issues with language.
I mean, there's still plenty of engelangers out there, but I think most of us don't have that feeling of we can conquer the world with it anymore, because there are so many obvious examples of people who thought that they could and failed miserably. So I think that drive still exists, but we just have a little bit more humility with knowing that it's really hard to do.
Yeah, and that drive, you know, who knows, like, who thought we could fly to the moon?
Right.
There are plenty of people working on that problem. But, you know, I think the problem you come to when engineering language is it's not really a question of who can engineer a good language. It's how do you control human behavior? And that's the problem you have to solve if you want to.
Oh, well, yeah. Adoption of a language and creating a language that has the features you want are totally different questions,
yeah.
Unfortunately.
And then there's just so much misplaced confidence over hundreds of years. Like, I finally figured it out. This is going to be the one. Like
the even more perfect language than my last edition.
Yes. But, you know, who could have known, you know, Esperanto would be what it is today. It succeeded in a way that if you read my book without Esperanto example in there, you'd have said, no way that's going to work. But it did something. It did something kind of unique.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't make any pronouncements about what is and isn't possible. But I don't encourage people to go out and start engineering better languages. Do it because you love it or enjoy it. Don't do it expecting that you'll get the Nobel Prize for it.
On that one, I definitely have to agree with you. I have to think that there's stories that you've come across or that you've had in the context of researching this book that didn't make it into the book. And I'm wondering if you'd mind sharing.
Well, the story of the split in Klingon didn't make it in. There was actually a split for a while among two schools of Klingon speakers, and they had two translations of Hamlet going, and now in the sort of official one and the unofficial one, and that other Klingon movement has kind of faded into the background now. But every language that gets any kind of success going ultimately has some big fight within its ranks. There isn't any that have just kind of, you know, once you attract 10 speakers, you've got 5 that think this should be done one way and 5 that think it should be done the other way. So yeah, the story of the split in Klingon into the Klingon Language Institute and the Interstellar Language School didn't make it in.
Do you know what the reason for that split was?
Differing ideas about how people should be using Klingon. So the other school was a little more flexible in how new words could be formed and how you could make compounds to create concepts. And the Klingon Language Institute, as it is extremely conservative. Nothing is proper Klingon unless it's in canon, which is basically anything Mark Okrand has written or anything that's been in the show. So you can conceivably know the entire canon for Klingon.
That's rather like the split that currently exists in Quenya, in fact, where you, on the one hand, you've got people like David Salo, mm-hmm. who are quite content to make up new words
with within Tolkien, Quenya. Yeah.
You have the other side, where they would rather just stick to the canon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, David Salo had a practical problem to deal with, which was creating dialogue for a movie.
Right.
And yeah, Tolkien really never meant his languages to be, he didn't provide enough information, and you know, there isn't a grammar in the way that there is one for Klingon for people to do that within the bounds of canon. But yeah, so again, you've got these languages with a following and you've got people who want to use it, and then you end up with a split along how it should be used. And that always happens when a language finds any amount of success. So beware, again. There are people who will ruin its perfection, and then they will wrest it from your grasp and start their own version.
And that's what you're going to be calling success.
Success, right. That's what you're going to live with.
So what about just you personally in researching this? Anything interesting in the course of it?
Well, I came to really, I don't know, I have a lot of compassion. There's a lot of big personalities in this. And when I started, I thought they were all complete fools, dreamy idealists and stubborn people out of touch with reality. How presumptuous to think you could sit down and figure it all out and trumpet about that.
Lunatics, as Yaguelo would have us.
Yeah. And but I, looking into everybody's life stories, I don't necessarily think any of them were less misguided, but they decided to solve a problem that many of us out there have toyed with, or lots of people will tell you they wish language is more logical, but no one's going to sit down and actually build the language that makes it more logical and sort of drive that thought to its logical conclusion. And so they don't have to suffer because of it. You can sort of offhandedly say, Chinese characters represent concepts better than English words. And you never sit down and actually try to make a language that works that way, and you never have to suffer for it and have everybody think you're crazy. So I have to give credit to the language inventors of history for taking these ideas at their word and trying to do something about it so that we can all see why that doesn't work. They probably didn't want to be remembered that way, but they have done a great service by, lots of them kind of ruined their lives over this and spent their lives in search of this goal and in search of other things like fame and fortune, which never came. And we get to look at those examples and say, okay, this is why this doesn't work very well. So, credit goes to them for that. I can't laugh at them anymore in the way that I did. I can still laugh about some things, but I can't laugh at them in the way that I did before, I guess.
That's probably good given that they're the subject of the book.
Yeah, they did something. It sort of makes me proud of being human, like, hey, we're going to get out there and solve problems. This is what we do. This is our urge. And some of us hit upon the right kind of problem and actually solve it. And some of us hit upon another problem that won't get solved. And, those people have worse outcomes, but their work is no less valuable. So, well, maybe not no less valuable. I guess I'd rather have penicillin than bliss and pollux, but still.
As a totally open question, is there anything else that you'd like to discuss about it?
I hope that that how I really feel about all this comes through in the book, because I sort of alternate between teasing mockery and grudging respect, and it's all sort of ground up in there together. And yeah, I hope that comes through, and I'm glad that people are out there doing all these things, and making art and living art, and there's nothing wrong with it, and people should know that it's being done. So.
Well, I for one am very glad you wrote this book, because I found it very interesting, and I learned a lot, actually, that I didn't know about the history of conlangs, and I thought it was a great book. I think the rest of the community will.
Oh, thank you. Great. Yeah, because this is an important audience.
Well, I'm well aware that the people who actually do this are going to be a trivial audience compared to the people who like crossword puzzles. And so
yeah, there's a lot more of those. But, you know, crossword puzzles are easy. Conlanging's hard. I can't even do it.
Thank you very much for being on the podcast. And I wish you the best of luck with your book.
Thank you very much. And yeah, and have a great conference.
You can learn more about Dr. Oken's book on its website in thelandofinventedlanguages.com or by going to podcast.conlang.org, where it will be linked in this podcast's show notes. Our intro and outro music is by Gary J. Shannon of fizzywig.com. Our audio editing and post-production is by Virgo Audio Production Services, virgoaudio.com. We are looking for more people to help in the production of this podcast, such as editing or providing original content. If you'd like to participate, or if you have any questions or comments, please email us at podcast@conlang.org. I hope you've enjoyed today's edition of the Language Creation Society podcast. See you next time. Fiat Lingua.